The Arab Spring had come to Egypt in early 2011 on the heels of a successful revolution in Tunisia. Egyptians took to the streets to demand reforms from a government regime that had been in power for nearly 30 years. While much of the media fixated on protesters who occupied Tahrir Square in the Egyptian capital of Cairo, many protests started in the port city of Alexandria. In Alexandria, as in Cairo, people from across generations and the socioeconomic scale rioted to demand liberty, justice, and social equity. In an attempt to restore the constitution, what was seen primarily as a peaceful uprising led to the deaths of at least 846 people, an additional 6,000 injured. On January 28th at 6 p.m., after the prisons had opened, releasing murderers and rapists onto the streets, all security withdrew from the streets of Alexandria. Roving gangs of looters took to the streets to take advantage of the chaos. In Egypt's port city, the violence and looting devastated government buildings where offices once stood, only burned out rubble remained. Protesters went from building to building, pulling down the symbols of corrupt power. Some looters and protesters then began to eye the Library of Alexandria. Seeing this, the peaceful protesters joined hand in hand and surrounded the Library of Alexandria to prevent any damage, any looting. By the end of the protest, when Mubarak was brought down, not a single window was broken, not a single rock was thrown against its walls. During the protest, the librarians were trapped inside the building. On the day after those looters went and took down the building, the peaceful protesters called out the librarians and the director. They asked if they could place a 30-meter-long flag of protest along the steps of the library. And from then on till the end of the protest, every morning before they would march down the street, they would walk by the flag and touch the flag. The question one asks is, why was it so important that they would save the library? Why, when they took down every other government building, they saved the one building built by Mubarak with his wife on the board? They saved the building. They saved the library. Why? Now, I tell you this story not because I'm going to answer the question of why. We'll get there. But when I tell this story to new and incoming library science students, they look at me in horror. Do I need to defend against a riot and a mob, they think? You know, it's bad enough that when they think they want to be public librarians, they feel they have to take social working classes. Now they think they have to take, you know, combat training. This idea that somehow we would be trapped in such extraordinary circumstances as an overthrow of a government, this seems beyond the pale and the ability of what we do. Of course, these days, I think librarians should take over the government because we wouldn't close the damn thing down. But that's another issue. Now I'm in the South, so I've got to be careful on who I blame for that. But the reason I ask this question, the reason I want to tell you this story, is because you're wondering what this has to do with the bee sitting on my screen. That is a worker bee. Right? By the way, in case you're wondering, they're all female, just as a side note. They do the real work, right? The men are sitting at home taking care of the queen. Can you imagine like a bee man cave? I mean, it'd all be hexagonal, but anyway. So, after I told this story in my incoming class, we have this online bulletin board called Scared Embarrassed, and it's an anonymous bulletin board where the students can post questions where maybe they don't feel comfortable asking in class, or they think it's a stupid question, or frankly, they whatever. And the next day after I used that story to introduce the class, someone posted going, I can't be an innovator. I don't have it in me, but I'd make a really great worker bee. You tell me what you want, and I can make it happen. Isn't that good enough? It led to a really interesting conversation, of which I'm going to sort of bring it back to you for a moment. Isn't it good enough to be a really good worker bee? You tell me what you need, I can organize it, I can take care of it, I can schedule it. Isn't that a sufficient? In fact, isn't that really the heart of librarianship, that it's all about organizing things? Why do I have to innovate? When I saw the theme of the conference on leadership, the subtitle involved collaboration and innovation. And I think the word innovation is the problem here. The word innovation is what scared this student into talking about worker bees. Because when we think of innovation, let's face it, we think of people like this, right? Wearing the black t-shirt. This is my Steve Jobs look. Hold on a moment. Right? And no. You know, that's too trendy, and you know, Apple's all fanboys and hipsters, and we don't play that game, so fine. The academic, think of Newton. He's fine. He's a good innovator. Right? Newton did a couple things in his life that we remember, besides apples falling on heads and such. You know, like calculus. You know, he had an extra day. He said, what am I doing today? New form of math. Right? He wrote this thing called Principia Mathematica, which was calculus. And it was so great and so important that for 100 years, a century, no one else wrote another math textbook. Wouldn't that be brilliant if we had that kind of staying power in our textbooks? But anyway, and all right, no. But really, we know that, you know, if you're at Syracuse, we had a student who came to us and said, if I hear about Thomas Edison one more damn time, I am going to throw up. Right? Just Thomas Edison and, you know, inventing light bulbs and phonographs and, you know, abusing his staff and stealing ideas and pissing off Tesla. Anyway, we put this image of innovation at such this high bar that it's almost like this godly power. That to innovate is something that takes people who are cool. Sometimes we talk about people who are young. Sometimes we talk about people who are in the technology industry when we think about innovation. We, no wonder if this is what we put ourselves up against, we want to be worker bee. Because let's face it, there's one Edison. There's one Newton. There's one Steve Jobs. But they can't do it all. When I think of innovation, I think of Danny. This is Danny Biasone. Danny, in the 50s, owned a professional basketball team in Syracuse, New York, called the Syracuse Nationals, or Nats. You now know them as the Philly 76ers. But Danny had a problem, which in the 50s, he was having an attendance problem. People weren't really paying to come and watch basketball. No one really sort of knew what basketball was. And frankly, basketball was extraordinarily boring. Now, from Syracuse, talking about basketball and boring is heresy. But at the time, it was. And I'll tell you why. At the time, the game was a defensive game. What would happen is you would score, you would go up and score, and you would sit on the ball as long as you could and wait for the clock to run out. So scores at this time were things like, you know, 25 to 30, right? Five, yeah, you can do a free throw. Anyway, yeah. And so the idea was it was deadly boring to watch. And Danny looked at this and said, something's got to happen here. And so what he did is he stole an idea from a college coach. And he said, I'm going to give a time limit. You have to shoot the ball. If you get the ball, you have to shoot the ball in 24 seconds. By the way, where did he come up with 24 seconds? He figured he wanted the average score to be about 80 and divided by the number of minutes in a regulation game. 24 seconds. The shot clock, as some of us now know it. He invented the shot clock. He didn't invent it. He adopted the shot clock purely to change the game, to make it more interesting, to get the scores going. And it did. Suddenly, you couldn't sit on the ball anymore. You had to be aggressive towards the net. Suddenly, you had to turn it into an offensive game. Suddenly, taller people mattered. Suddenly, the idea of slam dunks and getting a point and getting in there quickly changed dramatically. The game by the shot clock changed to the point where it was a rapid-acting game. At the same time, that television was growing in its importance and sports television was growing in its importance, and they were getting a little bored of baseball. And they were looking for another sport they could find, another sport that could help them that they could air. And they found basketball because suddenly, with this introduction of a shot clock, it was a much more exciting game. We could now televise it. People would watch it. It turned into a multi-billion dollar industry that we have today, all because Danny was bored. Now, the reason I bring up that story is that Danny innovated the game of basketball. He changed it, and his small change, 24 seconds for a shot, one rule change, created a new industry, created a new perception of the field, created new opportunities, but he never sat out and said, I'm going to create an $8+ billion sports empire with people who take steroids and all that wonderful stuff. Anyway, he innovated. He made one small change, and he didn't even invent it. But he looked and looked, how can I make it better, even if it's just that much? So what I want you to think about when we talk about innovation and being innovators is don't want you to think about, do I have to take on the world of rebels? Do I have to bring down a government or two? I want you to think about, can I come up with a shot clock equivalent in my library? Can I make that small adjustment that I hadn't thought about? By the way, the answer to the question about why didn't they tear down the library, why didn't they let it burn, was because the librarians within it weren't miracle workers. They weren't people who were extraordinary in the sense that it was occupied by a bunch of saints who walked around. It was occupied by librarians who, ready, did their job. Every day since the opening of that library, those librarians came in and they did their job and they did it damn well. They didn't see it as overthrowing the government. They were working for the government. They saw, I'm going to be the best reference librarian I can be. I'm going to be the best collections librarian I'm going to be. I'm going to be the best public service librarian I'm going to be. And every day throughout the opening of that library, they built a relationship to their community where they were of service. And so when people went to go pull it down and pull down the government, that library was no longer of the government. That library was of the people, the community. It was their resource, their asset, to the point that after the whole revolution happened, grandmothers and taxi drivers started coming into the library going, I heard about this Facebook thing. Could you show me what it is? I heard about this Twitter thing. It seemed kind of important. How does it work? And where was the greatest connectivity, the greatest speed to the internet? It was at the library. So what I'm asking you to do, and what we're going to spend a little time thinking about, is not how to be Steve Jobs and change the whole universe tomorrow. Feel free to do that. But how do I change a little bit? How do I change something? How do I think of innovation not as something outside of me, not as something supernatural, but part of my everyday activity, part of my everyday job? Do not have an hour you set aside to be innovative. It won't work. Because it's always in the shower. Is it me? You're sitting in the shower going, that's it. And you're looking for something to type on, and I've lost so many iPads that way. Anyway. So we know this. We're talking change management. And we're all good at this, right? We know how to do this. What we do is we start with today. This is today. What do we want to change? This is my library today. This is my collection development today. This is my reading program today. This is my curriculum today. You pick a thing that you want to sort of look at changing. And then you come up with a predicted future. This is what's going to happen to this. Now, I teach librarians, school librarians. Yes. I also teach undergraduates, which is hilarious. I got to tell a quick story about undergraduates. I'm sorry. I was in the hospital in February for like 20 days, and so I like taught via Skype, which is fun. And I was my first time teaching an undergraduate class in a decade. And so what happens is Leif Bennett, who also worked with us, would gather the papers from the undergraduates and bring them to me in the hospital, and I would grade them. And so one time I was grading the papers, and I was also getting vital signs taken on a regular basis, so they have the blood pressure cuff. And so there it is, there's my blood pressure. 20 minutes later, as I'm grading the papers, there it goes. My blood pressure had like dramatically risen to the point where they wanted to do an EEG, which only goes to point that undergraduates are bad for your health. So I can only imagine what high school students and middle, actually I have two middle school students, I can only imagine your health problems. But I also teach doctoral students, and doctoral students are fabulous at this. They love figuring out where things are going. They look at data, and they do, that's what's going to be. But here's the problem. Is that what's going to be? I want to ask you a question. What is the future for school libraries in the state of North Carolina? I heard that. That's my family motto, too, by the way, exasperated sigh. All right, it's a trick question because it's a crappy question. It's a horrible question. You want to know why it's a horrible question? A couple of reasons. First, what will be, what is the future. It's a definitive, right? Like there's one out there and we're just waiting for it to come to us. Right? Like the future. Bam! I guess it's here. Right? As opposed to what should be the future. That shift takes it from a passive waiting for it to kill me to an active, I'm going to shape it. Alan Kay, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Lincoln said something roughly equivalent, but anyway. That's the first one. The second one is, what should be the future of school libraries in the state of North Carolina? Well, I think the future of libraries is a really boring question. I frankly don't care what happens to the building and the organizational chart. I'm much more interested in what should be the future of school librarians and libraries in the state of North Carolina. How many people have written a report where you've talked about the library doing something? The library circulated this many books. The library bought this many books. The library had this author in. Crap. The library doesn't do anything except exert gravity and decay and go out of date with furniture, right? The librarians do it. Stop hiding behind your rooms. It's you that do this. And you that are going to craft that future. Now, you're not going to do it alone, but the thing is, besides the predicted future, you must have an ideal future. What do you want it to be? And if you do it right, there will always be a gap between what's the predicted future and the ideal future. I'm arranging deck chairs. This is great. Right. Now, that gap could be tiny, $10 between what you anticipated. But it could be enormous. I would like the VR holodeck from Star Trek sitting in my library. Thank you very much. I would. That would be great, wouldn't it? You know, no, it's a bad joke. I'll get myself in trouble. I'll leave it. Then what we do is we figure out, okay, working backwards, what are the steps it takes to get to that ideal future? And we call that an agenda. And we're good at this. How many statements, besides the fact that they're all libraries shall this and libraries shall that, stop it. But how many documents have we read from AASL and no doubt this group, from ALA, from blah, 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 that have this wonderful agenda to it. Thou shalt, thou shalt, thou shalt. We've read them all, 2020, etc. The problem is, this is great for the city on a hill. The shining city of lights on the hill, right? We can predict an ideal future, and we can work our task back, but there's a fundamental problem, which is it never seems to happen. Now, a fellow by the name of Lewin looked at this problem 60, 70 years ago, and he said, here's the problem with change. He looked at a change cycle. He said, if you want to implement change, if you want to innovate and think of something new, you've got to do two things, not one. The desired, the one sitting on the left-hand side there, your resetting norms, we'll get to that in a second, but we're good at envisioning the future. Here's the problem, he said. If you envision the future, it's not enough. What you have to do, in addition to making an attractive future that people want to go to, you have to make your present situation uncomfortable. What he said was, it's not enough to say this is where we want to go. You have to say, if you don't go there, this is the negative consequence that will occur. Now, we don't like that. We live it every day, but we don't like causing stress. But we have to. You have to say not simply, this is where we're going. You also have to give the, if we don't go there, this is what happens, and it's not good. Right? And then what happens is, when you try and then move from the present to the desired future, you enter into turbulence, his word. And that is that change is always turbulent. I think we love the idea of creating a sort of stressless change environment. It does not exist. If you move how you organize your books, and you move what you do, and you move from flexible schedule to fixed schedule, and if you move from on the credit card or on the report card to off the report, there's always stress. And what you need to know is, yes, there is always stress. And then Lewin says, the other problem happens is if you move people, you unfreeze them where they are, and you move them to the future, you have to, what he says, refreeze them. What does that mean? What that means is, People love normality. People love predictability. People love to know what's going to happen day to day. When you woke up this morning, you didn't want to wake up and say, gee, will my car start? Won't my car start? You know, will the asteroid blow up the Earth? Well, right, we want the idea that I'm going to get my coffee, I'm going to go in, this is going to happen. Right? So what he says is you have to refreeze them. In essence, think about when you move from one to another, did you come up with assessment goals? Did you come up with evaluation systems? Did you come up with performance reports? Did you come out with job descriptions? Did you give something so they can feel comfortable where they are? Sometimes we wonder why teachers don't move. Why don't they know we're brilliant? Sometimes we don't let them know how to tell that we're being brilliant. I know that sounds really weird, but the idea is we sometimes try to make things so seamless for them that it's like, look, items magically appeared in my box. How nice. The library fairies have helped me. We've got to every so often, so, you know, I've busted my ass, library fairy. This is, you know, we've got to show them what happened. Now, what I want you to know is that the good news is we're ahead of the game. As librarians of all spectrums, academic, public, school, special, medical, you name it, are in this changed environment trying to anticipate and build their future, we're ahead of the game because what we have to understand is the changes that we want to bring about to innovate is to literally engage in a learning activity. And we're in the learning business, right? So this is good. This is us. I have to say, I wrote this wonderful book, if I do say so myself, called The Atlas of New Librarianship. Don't tell anyone, but it could be subtitled about how school librarians are leading the whole field into something more interesting, which is we're about learning. Right? Learning is change. You are in the change business. But I want to be really clear. Just because you're in a school doesn't make you an educational activity. Allow me to give you an example. It's in a school. Coke must be about learning. No. They're about advertising and building large stadiums that drain our budgets. But that's another issue. Right? The idea is just because you're in the school does not mean that you are in the learning business. If you are a school librarian and you think of yourself as an educator because you're in a building and all you do is pay attention to the books and materials, you are not in the learning business. You are in the maintenance business. Amen. Thank you. Right? What defines you as a learning business, what defines you as an educator isn't the fact that you're in the building. It defines by your mission. And that mission for a librarian is to improve society. Feel free to stop your mission there. But how do we do it? Through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. Once again, for you guys, you look at this and go, yeah. But I can't tell you the number of academic librarians who looked at that and said, oh, no. I'm in the information business. Okay, quick test. What is information? We all think we know what information is, but if you actually sit down and say, is it stuff? Is it books? Is it data? Is it ones and zeros? Is it my iPad? Don't ever use the word information. It doesn't mean, I'm in a school of information studies. I asked my colleagues. I asked 5 different faculty members, how do you define information? I ended up with 10 different definitions. My favorite was, I don't know. And we're paid to do this crap. Right? So what I want you to think about is, what does a truly learning-based library look like? What does a school library media program that is centered on learning look like? And my question is, if you assume you have one now, does it look like this? So first of all, we have to deal with that learning is about conversations. We're going to talk about these in a second. That conversations are about participation, and that participation is about co-ownership. So, is your library program set up to facilitate conversations, allow for participation, and is it truly co-owned by your students and faculty? Let's start with the first one. So, this is Gordon Pask. I long for the day that I would get a picture like that. That's a real guy. He's not dressed up. I mean, the bow tie and the hair. Gordon Pask was, as I say, a chemically enhanced professor, which may be why he looked like that. in England, and what he wanted to do was he wanted to teach machines how to think, artificial intelligence. And he figured that you'd start with natural intelligence and see if he could emulate it. So he went and looked at how people learn, and he came up with this thing called conversation theory. And conversation theory says that to learn, people engage in a conversation. Now those conversations may be between two people. They may be between groups of people. They may be between one person and lots of people. And then, if we go up, he said learning, a lot of it is with ourselves. And if you're sitting there going, how do you have a conversation with yourself? Let me ask, who did you ask, how can I have a conversation with myself? Now, did anyone take the MOOC this summer? We did one on New Librarianship. Anyone? Yes? I'm sorry. I taught one. I didn't realize it was, you know, three semesters worth of work in a month. But thank you. If you were in the MOOC, you would know that some people aren't thrilled with conversation theory, and it's old, and it's obscure, and all this other stuff. So fine. How about metacognition, constructivism and constructionism, Dewey, John Dewey, that is, because Melville Dewey, the guy was an anti-Semitic misogynist who wanted to bring us to the metric system. This is the ideal that we hold out for our group. Anyway, we talk about critical thinking, we talk about reflective reading, all of these come around to the idea that we are engaged in thoughtful, meaningful conversations with others, and a lot of them with ourselves. Right? So this isn't too foreign and strange. You guys have certification, you went through teaching, you've heard this all before. I'm not going to spend much more time on it other than to say it's about conversations. Right? We know this from pedagogy. We know this. So what is our role as school librarians in this note, in a conversation? We facilitate these conversations. How do we facilitate conversations? Well, there's a rough equivalent to the idea of getting someone to an idea to the idea of a digital divide. Right? One of the things that we looked at in the early 90s was that we saw lots of conversations going online, lots of materials and resources going online, but people weren't getting there. We talked about something called the digital divide. And it was defined at the time as people don't have computers. People don't have stuff. Right? And so that's the first divide, which is access, getting people to a conversation. But then we realized that once they're there, that doesn't necessarily mean they know what to do or how to engage in it. How many people were a victim of the laptop revolution in schools? And I mean that by the day before school, you got your first laptop or a smart board and said, oh. Right? You had access. What the hell's wrong with you? Right? That'll play very well, by the way, in the screencast of this. Anyway. So, knowledge, once you're there, how to use it is important. But then the other one is, so you can get there, you know what to do, but do you feel comfortable doing it? How many people have been in a meeting with the historian?
You're sitting there going, well, I better do that story.
The historian is the person that whenever you come up with a good idea, raises their hand and starts a sentence with, what you have to remember is. I think that we should use Twitter to communicate with our parents.
What you have to remember is that we tried this in 1932.
I was watching a comedian. He was talking about how he read a tweet from his friend going, the power's out in my apartment. It feels like I'm living in the 1800s. And he said, he tweeted on his iPhone that he thinks he's living in the 1800s. The rest of the joke went, if he really was doing that, I would have walked out my door, run into a horse with the person who would have handed me a small scroll saying, I feel like I'm living in the 1800s. Right? So even though we're there, that historian tends to shut things down. Right? Oh, well, we have to do more data. We have to do more analysis. We have to do this. They're the no people. The two most important questions you need to ask every day are why and why not. They're the why people. Why should we do this? Why? That's a good, important question. But if we don't team it with why not, it's a much more interesting question. Well, why not?
Well, once again, for the screencast.
And the last one is, we're there, we know what to do, we feel comfortable doing it.
Do we want to?
This is the motivation side. So I want you to think about, what does it look like in terms of your library facilitating conversations? Right? So, conversations, in terms of how do you provide access to conversations? First thing you need to know is I asked about conversations, not stuff. In reference, we teach about the worst reference practice, which is get the person to a resource and get the hell out. I'm doing a report on Christopher Columbus. Have you seen the World Book Encyclopedia? See you later. I'm doing a report on pornography in schools. Have you seen? No. What? So, but the conversations. Do you have students, for example, who are interested in a topic and you run into another student who's interested in a topic or a faculty or a parent? How do you combine them? How do you connect them? How do you bring them people in? We've done a lot of this. Bringing authors into our schools is a great way of engaging in a conversation, and it's different than simply handing them the book. If they're reading the book, very, very, very important, they're engaged in an internal conversation. I want to be very clear on this point. When you're reading a book, you are having a conversation. And it's not with the author. If you're reading Shakespeare, he's dead. I'm sorry. Someone said, can I still believe in Santa? Sure. But you're having a conversation with yourself. We know this. This is an internal conversation. But how about conversations with other people? When you get that person who's interested in history, do you have someone in the community that may be a history professor, a history buff, a historian? Do you bring them in from outside? How do you connect them? How do you provide that? Access not only to stuff, but access to conversations. How do you bring people together? And I want to be really clear here. Common Core cannot be another cataloging exercise. And I know that someone's, I think, in the very next session doing something on finding Common Core resources, so hold on a moment before you throw things at me. If we look at Common Core as, here are the standards, we need to find stuff that matches the standards and hand them off to the teacher and walk away, we have not only failed in our job, we have failed at Common Core. Common Core is supposed to be about critical thinking. It's supposed to be a conversation. It's supposed to be about literacy. And if we defer that literacy and we defer the conversation, we simply treat it as here's stuff, we have failed in Common Core, we have failed in our profession, and we are failing in the opportunity presented to us. I can't tell you the number of people where the librarians go, well, now they understand what we're doing because of Common Core. Great, say that behind the scenes. Don't say it in front of the teachers. What you say in front of the teachers is, you know, we've been doing kind of Common Core stuff for our entire profession. Maybe we can help. Maybe we can be part of it. And don't treat it as, I'm just going to create a bunch of novels and a bunch of, what is it, nonfiction resources to provide people and walk away. Our job is to change the world, not catalog it. Not describe it. In terms of knowledge and training, one of the things we've always talked about is information literacy. We provide information literacy. Now, if you're really providing how to use a library, you're failing in that task. And I want to make it something more important. When you say the word literacy, it is not a series of skills. Mike Eisenberg was my advisor. I know the big six. I buy the big six. It's great, but if you dig into the big six, it's not simply about how to search the web. Information literacy, literacy of any sort, is about power. It is about enabling people to do something, to take a stream of information literacy, to take a text, to take mathematics, to take whatever, and to find regularities and then manipulate the regularities to do something. You are teaching people to be powerful. That's what we need to think about with information literacy. In terms of the environment, how do we provide safety? Safety, not only in the sense of physical safety. I mean, we all know that we have kids that come to the library so they won't be other places where they're in danger, either from bullying, from social pressure, what have you. We provide that physical safety, and that's important. But what about intellectual safety? How do we let them know that it's okay to ask those embarrassing questions? How do we let them know that it's okay to have this interest in that? How do we fulfill the idea that librarianship is about freedom of access of information, ideas, and thoughts? And how do we do that in a world full of filters? I was part of a group that was looking at information literacy, and we said the worst place ever to teach the internet and literacy skills on the internet is a school. Why? Because schools have become rarefied environments of the good stuff, big quotes, right? We need negative examples. But who's the first one to stand up at the PTG meeting and say, I would like to bring more crap into my library. Is that okay? No. So we bring them into a rarefied environment where they can't happen into bad stuff. and we don't let them get it when we're there to help and guide and direct, and we send them home where they can do all of that on their own without any guidance. Anyway, or better yet,
I'm sorry, I got to complain about my school.
We spend $400 giving our children the best, most interesting thing they have in their life, and we send them to school where we make them put it away. I had to spend $180 freaking on a graphing calculator. It could have been a $2 app. I feel better now. All right. Why don't librarians handle the bring your own technology to class exercises? And maybe we can do better than LA when they handed them.
Did you see the LA story? They bought all their students iPads and they handed them out, and within like 2 days, the students had hacked them to get rid of all the restrictions and everything off of it. It's like, make the students in charge of the technology. Clearly, you can't handle it. And motivation. How do we deal with the idea that people come in because they have to, extrinsic motivation? But what's great about it is, think about your schools. Your schools are full of extrinsic motivation. They're full of things where the outside world tells your students what they have to do. You have to learn this math. You have to do this reading. You have to do this homework. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to do this. We are this wonderful oasis of inquiry-driven instruction. When people can come in and go, I just want to know about snakes. Yes! Let's go! That's what we need to do. And you're never going to learn that if you go, well, we don't have a book on snakes. That's not the answer. Bring a snake into the school. It'd be great. What could go wrong? So learning. You know, the problem is I stand up here and like 50 jokes go through my mind and I have to filter them by, okay, I'm in public. Don't want to say that out loud, and you know, and my mother might hear this someday. All right, so learning is about conversations, and conversations are about participation, right? We need to ditch the deficit model. The deficit model is when we look at our students as this walking bag of missing parts. It's like they would be a fully grown adult if they only knew algebra. Quick, plug in algebra. My sister was growing up, I think in reference to me, had the best line. She goes, teenagers lack the vitamin brain. And I think that that's important to think about. Right? What that means is we keep looking at, they can't read, they can't do this, they need this tutoring, they need this support. And yes, they do need that sort of remediation support. But there's so much more than just what they're missing. There are dreams and aspirations and skills that people, these students that we bring to us, bring things that we don't have. How do we celebrate that? How do we highlight that? How do we connect it? Can we simply say, you're really interested in manga comics? See that 20 feet of linear shelving? Knock yourself out. Right? And this is, by the way, me, in case you're wondering. And this was me at the Cleveland Clinic, which is wonderful. And those are about 32 leaves on the top of my head. The person who put the leaves on the top of my head said, they look for the bald guys. That's the one they want. That was me. And they're looking for the reason I was having some seizures, which is delightful, and they didn't find anything, including the cancer that was growing just about 1 foot lower. My point of that, besides trying to get, you know, the pity vote, is you find what you're looking for. If your school, if your curriculum, if your library program is built around remediation and the idea of bringing people up to a bar, you will find the deficiencies. If your library media program is about helping people fulfill their dreams, possibilities, and capabilities, that's what you'll find. And if you look at Creative Core as a bunch of slots to be filled, great. It's a testing to be done, great. That's what you're going to find. You're going to teach to the test. But if you look at these as opportunities for greater collaboration, greater success, and greater importance of the field, that's what you'll find. The collection that you are maintaining, that you are moderating, that you are dealing with is not in your stack. It is not in your physical facility. It is your students and faculty. That is your collection. And it is a brilliant, rich, amazing collection. It is richer and broader than you will ever find in the written word. We need to stop training people to read poetry and read novels and read science texts and begin preparing them to write poetry and write novels and be a scientist.
That's what we do. And that our participation means we need to be co-owned. This is Sue Kowalski at the Pine Grove Middle School. And what she's done, she won an ASL Program of the Year, and she created this thing called I-Teams. And the I-Teams are her students, and she started out with like 4, and now she has like literally 100 people in the I-Teams at a mid-sized middle school. What do the I-Teams do? They do tech support, not just for her. Her library is a place where people can come and participate, but they're also, if someone calls up and says, this smart board's in my room, I don't know what to do with it, she sends a student down to show the teacher how to do it. And the teachers initially went, right? Like you all, in your mind, you're thinking, Now they request the students to come and do it. Now they build projects around the students. She built a series of trust exercises. So she didn't start by sending the students down with the technology. She started by saying, do you have a project that you're working on in your school? Maybe I have some students who could help you. And she helped the students do the research and helped them, and they built a relationship, and now they are the tech support for the school. They do the shelving. She doesn't do the shelving. If you are truly a learner-centered institution, look at how much time you spend and how much money you spend and where is it spent. Is it on the stuff and the artifacts of the collection in the room, or is it on the programs, the people, and their learning? Right? Collaborative buying decisions. When she comes up and says, we have this pot of money, she doesn't make the decisions and take the best of list. She literally says to the students, what do you want? And they sit and have conversations and discussions, and they make the purchasing decisions to the point where ever, if there's ever a bad order, they'll go online and tell Sue how she misentered the data. She believes in these students. These students that started as the outcast, that started as the awkward student, she's given them purpose. Sometimes the students come in for, I don't kid you, 10 minutes just because they can do their time. They want to be on time. They want to have that responsibility. They have parents calling Sue when their student's sick to say that they won't be able to do their shift in the library. She believes in the students. She buys them. She centered them on the students. My bottom line to you is that librarians are radical, positive change agents. I said this once and someone said, I never thought I'd hear a librarian used in the same sense as radical. I said, get used to it. Think about the word radical for a minute. There are 3 different definitions for radical. The first one is what we all think of, right? That crazy leftist, bring down the government side. Okay, activism. The second meaning of radical actually means fundamental. If you have a radical mastectomy, it doesn't mean the doctor tried something crazy. It means they took the entire organ, a radical procedure. A radical in biology means the root system. Actually, my biologist may correct me, but it's the fundamental thing of it, everything grows from. So it's fundamental. And the third meaning of radical is like, cool, radical. I love the fact that librarians encompass all 3 of those. We are cool people who want to change it based on our values and our mission. We're not just out to innovate for crazy things. Innovation means positive change. It doesn't just mean change. How many of you, every time they talk about the new curriculum in, sit back and go, begin the 2-year countdown. Creative Core is gone. Next, right? That's just change for change's sake. We want change that makes life better, right? We want to be radical, positive change agents. And if you want to be radical, positive change agents, you need to be that. If you want to produce radical, positive change agents, you need to model it. If you don't want to produce worker bees, don't be a worker bee. If you want to produce exceptional, be exceptional. How can we expect our students who are going to run this country, who are going to be in control of our destiny, who are going to invent new things, who are going to cure cancer and go to the moon and all these wonderful things, if we look at them as a bunch of deficiencies and we sit as a conservative, non-changing organization and hope it happens? If you don't like a testing culture, change it. I want to be really clear. It doesn't stop with our students. We are not consumers. They are not consumers. We do not take technology so that we can simply watch videos, play games, and ignore the world. We don't teach reading to distract people from the reality. We teach the reading to change the reality. We are not clerks. We are not at the mercy of publishers and test preparers. We are not victims. If someone sits there and talks about the problem with school libraries, is school librarians, we need to change their mind. The next time they ever talk about the school library and don't mention you, tell them that they named the room after you, not the other way around. This image, this thought that somehow librarianship is a conservative bastion of the introvert, is a place for clerks and people who don't want to think strategically, has to be destroyed. And it won't be destroyed by others, and it won't be destroyed by happenstance. It will be destroyed by every person in this room. You have an obligation to lead. You cannot be a worker bee. There is no such thing. We don't have the room in our profession. We all have to be innovators. We all have to be advocates. We all have to be change agents. We do it student by student, faculty by faculty, foot on the ground, classroom by classroom, legislator by legislator. But every day we meet with them, we change minds. The business that we are in is not materials, it's not facilities, it's not information literacy. The business we are in is improving society. We produce the most valuable product in any economy, in any democracy, and that is citizens. Not consumers, not users, not customers. Citizens. Those students that we train today are the people who will run this country, or the people who will make these decisions. That is too valuable a proposition to leave to a test, to leave to someone else. Every day, we must be recommitted to finding the greatness that is among us and around us and build on it. That collection that you work on has nothing to do with boundaries and binderies and paper and shelving. That collection, the most valuable collection in this society, is in your care, our children, our students, and their dreams. And I know we're up to that challenge. Thank you very much. This is my favorite part. Questions?